You are about to witness history in the making. Despite the world's highest living standards, the average American remained vaguely discontent, aware that his goal of a better way of life had still not been fully realized. There was something missing.
There's this awful gap in our lives just because we don't have... Oh, but why talk about it?
It's just that... Oh, I keep hoping someone can find a way to...
Don't be a fool, Mary. You know that's impossible.
Oh, I know. It's just that...
Gad, it's ironic. With all our technology and industrial know-how, we still don't have the one thing that could give us a better way of life.
It's the Forgotten Filmcast.
How can you say no and still keep your friends? Now that's quite a problem sometimes. Well, let's sit in on a discussion of that problem.
Welcome to episode 180 of the Forgotten Filmcast. My name is Todd Lieben-Allen. Thanks for joining me for this look at the movies that time forgot. On this episode, I'll be joined by Mike DeKalb from Out of Touchstone to discuss a 1988 film that was written by David Mamet, but only has a PG rating. Starring Don Ameche and Joe Mantegna, directed by David Mamet, it's Things Change. But first...
Do you remember when you told me that I might have such strong feelings about a boy that it might be hard for me to decide what's right to do?
Yes, I remember, but why?
Well, it was something like that tonight with...
The Forgotten Filmcast.
There are words men live by, words of strength, of wisdom, and of peace. We urge you to find the spiritual comfort and guidance we all so greatly need by attending your place of worship regularly.
Let's all go to the lobby. Let's all go to the lobby. Let's all go to the lobby to get ourselves a treat.
Delicious things to eat.
The popcorn can't be beat.
The sparkling drinks are just dandy. The chocolate bars and the candy. So let's all go to the lobby to get ourselves a treat. Let's all go to the lobby to get ourselves a treat.
Drive away your worries and cares at this drive-in theater, where you will see the finest motion pictures of all time, soon to be released. Drama, comedy, adventure, excitement, something for everyone. Here's a brief glimpse of some of the truly fine pictures we've scheduled in the near future.
How do you like that? Not a cop within a mile from here. Go get me a cop.
Sure.
What?
It's Laugh Ahoy, my hearties. We're the new comedy rage of the nation. Those gay, goofy, hilarious nitwits of the Navy, Bud Abbott and Lou Costello, in a bigger, better, funnier show than Buck Private, in the Navy.
Taste that dish. Shall we?
Mm-hmm. They'll torpedo your troubles and blitz your blues, aided by this grand cast of fun and music makers. Dick Powell, those song-sational boogie-woogie singers, the Andrews Sisters, lovely Claire Dodd, Dick Foran, Butch and Buddy, Shemp Howard, the Condos Brothers, in the merriest Navy musical that ever hit the screen.
What do I care about the petty officer? I got no use for a petty officer.
So I see. Could this possibly belong to you, sailor?
Thanks, buddy.
Attention the bridge! Manned battleships! Launch aircraft!
So long, goodbye sailor, see you again. Cause you're off to see the world and see what makes it tick. And earn your promotion, but do it quick. So long, but not forever, goodbye. We'll see you again when you put back into port. So long, bon voyage to you, cause you're off to see the world.
Open? Yes, sir, it is.
Okay, you got black, you got red, you got numbers. What do you want to bet?
I take a black.
Take a number. Take a number.
Okay.
You pick a number, it hits, pays 35 to 1. Put $5 on a number.
We're partners.
No, it's yours.
Yeah, no, we're partners. Whatever happened, we're 50-50, okay?
Yeah, okay.
Okay.
You know what? You know what number I always play?
Mm.
My flight number. What flight did we come in on? 12, wasn't it?
Yeah,
I think you're right. I think that it was number 12.
Hey, Miles, I gotta talk to you.
Not now, Jake.
The number is 12.
I win.
Yes, sir.
You see what my friend did?
Bravo, Mr. Johnson. Good play.
We got to lose the lighting guy. He's napping on me up there. I'm not saying it's hurting the show. It's not hurting the show. But have you seen the show? Have you seen the show, Mr. Johnson?
And here's your winning, sir.
Have you seen the show?
No, I can't say that I have.
What do you mean you haven't seen the show? How long have you been here?
Place your bets.
What do you do for entertainment? Just kidding. Don't miss the
show. $1,000 on number 12.
Okay, look, there's a bit I do. I'm working the crowd.
This is not the time, Jackie.
I just want to make a point here. You got a beautiful show, a fine show, well thought out. But if you don't have the support, this is my theme and what I'm telling you, support.
12 again.
I win again.
Yes, sir, you did.
How much we win?
$35,000.
We're flying number 12. We play number 12.
It's a lot of money.
Yeah.
What number you want to play now?
No. That's enough. Come on. I'll buy you a car.
Sir.
Yeah, hold on a second.
What's happening? Just
want
himself a couple of bucks.
Gino.
Hey, what do we do with this money, huh?
Gino, we gotta give it back.
Why? I win this.
Yeah, but I win this money. Yeah, but listen. It's a thing of hospitality. We're guests in their hotel. We could take the money. It's not a question of the money. It's just for the sake of honor. To be an honorable guest.
There's another money. It's honor.
Okay, our movie this time is Things Change from 1988. And joining me to discuss this film is Mike DeKalb from Out of Touchstone. Mike, welcome back to the show.
I am so honored that you have me back on. You know, it was so funny when I set up this call, I looked and I saw that I was on in November of 2019. Todd, has anything happened in the last 4 years that I should know about?
I don't know. I've been locked away in the house all that time. I have no idea. No. No, yeah. Yes, it's been an eventful couple years, but, you know, so yeah, it was about time to get you back on the show here. For the folks that were not with us that last time, why don't you remind them who you are and what you do?
Okay, yeah, as you said, my name is Mike DeKalb. Thank you for correctly pronouncing my last name. It's always a little tricky. I am the co-host of a podcast called Out of Touchstone, and it was it came out of a brainchild of one of my oldest friends. He and I went to film school together. And then we both worked at 20th Century Fox at the same time. And we grew up with those wonderful movies of the 80s and 90s, just like you did. And everyone knows that logo. Everyone knows that Touchstone logo with the blue circle and the lightning bolt. And there was a particular weekend that it was a Friday night. And my wife showed me Sister Act. She loves Sister Act. And I watched it and I really enjoyed it. I'd never seen it before. And then the next day, Saturday morning, we were working at Fox. Disney had bought Fox, so we were Disney employees at the time. And so they had a Disney employee screening of the Lion King remake. And it was like 8 a.m. at a local AMC. And I fell asleep watching it. You know, it was a little too early. And it kind of hit me that I was like, you know, in the 90s, in the 80s, you know, Disney had Touchstone. And they could make an original idea like Sister Act and get a sequel and a Broadway musical. And now they keep talking about trying to do a third one.
Yeah.
So they built the franchise from scratch. Whereas nowadays, this is what they're doing. They're doing these live action remakes. And I don't want to be one of those get off my lawn kind of old people, but that's just what Disney's doing. And I totally get it. That's where the film industry has gone. But I was just thinking about all those old movies that we missed. And it kind of got to where it was like, I think both you and I are the same in that a lot of the Touchstone catalog is stuff that you've either seen it, you saw a trailer for it in a movie theater at one point, or you haven't quite heard of it, but even if you know the people that were attached to these movies, you know? Mm-hmm. And we looked it up and it was like, I think like 200, 210 movies. I'm like, that's not so bad. That gives you enough content to last a few years. And it's what we've been doing. And the funny thing is, when I was on your show, I think we had just started. We'd only knocked out a couple of episodes because I think what had happened was I was trying to make sure no one else had done this idea. And I came across the podcast you did called Walt Sent Me. And I was like, okay, I know there are people out there that do Disney movie podcasts, but no one's doing it in order. And also people are doing different props. They're doing Miramax or they're doing Dimension and they're adding Hollywood. And I was like, let's just look at the Touchstone movies. Now, granted, when 1990 hits and Hollywood Pictures comes into play, we started kind of watching those and just, we don't go into deep dives. Like the Touchstone movies, we do a really, really deep dive and we look at the history. We're not film critics. My big thing is it's not a film review podcast. It's a film history podcast. I like to look at what went into the making of it. Why did it get made? What were the actors and the filmmakers doing before that helped them get it? And then I look at the box office and how did it do? And then so when we got into the 90s, we started looking at the Hollywood Pictures and the Walt Disney Pictures and trying to think of it through the minds of a marketing executive and say, look at how these movies were planned out. And then we look at the box office of all of them and kind of compare and contrast and look at what Jeffrey Katzenberg, his idea when he was running Disney about how he wanted, what did we call it? He called it the singles and doubles. You know, don't do home runs. Just do singles and doubles, lower budget. Let's see if we can make some money.
It's Moneyball for movie scheduling. Yeah.
Yeah. he was doing sabermetrics back in the day, I guess. And so it's been pretty interesting. But I'm not watching all the Hollywood movies, but if there's a lot of them that sound pretty interesting. I was talking to someone recently who used to work at Disney, and I told him about the podcast, and he was like, I said, yeah, we're watching some of the Hollywood Pictures. And he was like, well, you know our motto when we used to work at Hollywood Pictures, right? When we used to distribute those movies. And I was like, no, what? He said, if it's Sphinx, it stinks.
I said,
you know what? I said, we just wrapped up 1994 on our show with one of the best Touchstone movies ever, which is Ed Wood.
Absolutely.
We also had one of the best Hollywood Pictures, which was Quiz Show, you know? And so it's like, there are some good ones. We just watched Terminal Velocity. That was one of the Hollywood ones. And I like that. That's goofy fun. But we'll see going forward. Katzenberg leaves at the end of 94. I'm curious to see how the movies change a little bit as we get on to the 90s. But yeah, and I mean, we took a little bit of a hiatus, unfortunately. I bought a house and it kind of cut into my time. But we're back and we crank out episodes we try to do it every 2 weeks. And if I get the occasional interview, I just did an interview with Ron Shelton. I met him at a book signing. He has a great new book out about the making of Bull Durham. And And I was like, hey, you want to come talk about the two Touchstone pictures that you directed? And he was like, okay, sure. And he got had him on Zoom. And we just watched a movie. Have you ever seen Renaissance Man with Danny DeVito?
I have indeed. In fact, I saw Renaissance Man in the theater.
In the theater, yeah. That's one of those movies that I had never seen. That's kind of why I'm really glad I have this podcast. And when I was doing the research on it, I looked up the screenwriter, and it was his first movie. And I was trying to figure, who is this guy? And I looked it up, and he's a screenwriting professor at the University of Michigan. And so I just went to the Michigan's website, and it had his email address. And I just shot him an email, and I was like, hey, I'm doing this podcast. We're about to do Renaissance Man. Can you just tell me how it came about? Because I'm curious, you know, why you don't have any writing credits before. And he wrote me back like 5 minutes later, and he says, give me your phone number. I can tell you all about Renaissance Man. And I was like, oh, wow. So we had an interview. I talked to him for like almost 2 hours. I think I asked him 6 questions. I just let him go. And he told me the entire production of Renaissance Man. And
that's awesome.
Yeah, it's pretty fascinating. So yeah, we're wrapping up 94, going into 95 with our new episodes. Yeah.
When I first found out about your podcast, because like I say, we kind of connected because I used to have another show called Walt Sent Me. I was like, oh, I love this concept because I am, like you, intrigued by this history of this studio. I would always see that logo pop up and I thought it was great. And I remember, you know, back in 84, you know, when I went to see Splash in the movie theater, that was the first Touchstone film. And then to find out, oh, well, yeah, that's actually Disney. And it's like, oh, you know, and being a big Disney fan, I've just been intrigued by the history of Touchstone and Hollywood Pictures and all those other offshoots. That's part of why I had that other show for many years. And, you know, it continues, you know, as they do different things. You know, they've got Fox now and all that. I mean, there's a part of me that's like, oh, that's exciting. But I don't know. Do you think there's ever a chance, you know, now that they have 20th Century Fox and that, are we ever going to see a return of Touchstone Pictures, you think?
I mean, I doubt it. But I mean, you never say never because I've been working in the film industry for about 20 years, and I worked for MGM, and I love that job. It was really cool because I'm so fascinated by film history, and especially the film history of like the 80s and 90s. I know that there's a lot of people that wax nostalgic about the 70s and the rise of the auteur. I'm an 80s kid. I love Canon and Orion Pictures and stuff like that. And Canon and Orion were both properties of MGM. And so it was really fun to work there. I would go to movie screenings of Canon and Orion movies, and I would talk to the people that at the theater and stuff like that. And I was like, that's Mike from MGM. For a while there, they kind of knew me. I used to go to Tarantino's theater, the New Beverly. And I remember going there one night for a midnight screening of a movie called Modern Girls with Virginia Madsen.
Oh, I know that one. Yes. Daphne Zuniga. Cynthia Gibb. Come on, talk about a trifecta of 80s cuteness. Give me a break.
Oh my God. Cynthia Gibb. I had a big crush on her from Fame. Yeah. And
Short Circuit too. Yeah.
I had just done an order for that movie, and they had a Q&A with the I think it was like she had written the movie, and we were walking into the theater, and the guy that used to moderate a lot of the screens there is a guy named Phil Blankenship, and he got to know me. He was like, oh, that's Mike from MGM, and he introduced me to her at the screening, and I was like, oh, I work at MGM. I just kind of had done some work on Modern Girls. Somebody ordered it for like to air in Turkey or something. And she's like, oh, you gotta help me. It'd be nice to make more than like $5 in residuals or something like that, which is so funny. And so I guess there's like a Modern Girls fan club. And it was like these two girls who had driven up from San Diego, and they were filming. I think it's on YouTube. You can find it somewhere. They're filming her Q&A before. I think it was before the movies. In the midnight screenings, it would always be an introduction rather than a Q&A afterwards. You're not doing 2 a.m. Q&A. And they were talking about the production and yada, yada, yada. And somebody said, oh, when's this going to movie on DVD or something like that? And I kid you not, the screenwriter of the movie was like, I believe we have a executive here from MGM. You should ask him. I'm like waving my hands. I'm like, no. I'm just a worker bee. I don't have any kind of power like that. So, but the point I was going to get at was, I believe, correct me if I'm wrong, Todd, but I thought MGM had tried to relaunch Orion recently, at least use that name for some
I think movies. You may be right. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So I don't know if now would Disney bring back Touchstone? We'd have to see. But I feel like one of the reasons I failed to mention, one of the reasons that I guess a sort of side effect of creating the podcast was more for professional purposes. When I was at Fox, my job was working with catalog features. I would master these old movies. If they wanted to air something in Italy, we had to make sure we had the Italian dub and stuff like that. And so I was like, well, when Disney bought Fox, I'm like, okay, well, I should learn Disney's library as well, because I'm going to need to know this for my job. And then they lay me off, unfortunately. And so I never really got the chance to use it. I was since rehired. I do work at Disney again now. I do more television, but I have friends who do the TV stuff and will be in meetings, and I'll just be like, oh, I just had to watch What About Bob for my podcast. And they'll be like, oh yeah, we just did an order for that or something. So it's kind of nice to become a little bit knowledgeable. And then like I said, the guy who told me if it Sphinx, it stinks, he was a legend in Disney. He worked there for 30 years, and he was ran their post-production department and did their film restoration to the 90s. And when I told him I had to watch It's Pat for my show, the greatest quote, he said, the best part about It's Pat is that it's only four reels long. And I was like, okay, good to know. And so I did see him again. I saw him recently because his company might be doing some work with us. And so we're just talking shop. It's kind of funny to – I'm only in my late 40s, but, you know, I go to film conferences and I see these old grizzled guys that have been working on, you know, 35 millimeter three per film for years. And I'm just this younger guy. And now I'm actually – kind of in the know, you know, so it's kind of funny. Now, maybe I'll hand out a Touchstone business cards. I got a few of those printed up and see if anyone's listening to my show or not. But yeah.
Excellent. Yeah. Well, let's get on with this movie here. It is not a Touchstone movie. It's not a Hollywood Pictures movie. It's not related to Disney in any way because, you know, we like Touchstone, but we like lots of other studios too.
Todd, so, how did you pick this movie, Todd? I want to know.
I just put things on a list and say to my guests, what strikes your fancy? So, you know, this is the one that came out. It's one I knew of back in the day, but yeah, I had never gotten around to seeing. And that's part of the point of the show, is to see things I've never seen before. So this is Things Change from 1988, directed by some guy named David Mamet, who, you know, Pulitzer Prize winning, Tony Award winning playwright. The guy's kind of well known, you know.
Yeah, that's the reason I chose this. You gave me the list and I was like, ooh, Mamet, because I know some of his stuff. I'm familiar with a lot of his work. I've never seen a live stage production of a Mamet play. Have you?
No, I have not.
I've seen a handful of his movies. I mean, if you want, I could tell you now, or we could save it for later. I have bumped in. I've been in the same room with him three different times, and once very memorably. But that's why I was like, oh, I don't know this movie, and it's Mamet. And of course, as we're going to get into, it's got that Mamet stable of actors. So I'm kind of glad you chose. I'm glad you chose this one because it kind of fits into my wheelhouse, right? That late '80s. Sort of a comedy. If you want to, I'm using comedy with finger quotes. You can't see me, but
it's a different Mamet take on the comedy for sure. Yeah. And I think I don't know a whole lot about Mamet's work, you know, because I haven't seen that much. You know, a lot of it is theater, and you know, I have the basics of him, but you know, from what I understand, this is quite different than what people expect out of him. But yeah, we'll get into that here in a moment. He does have a partner in this, though. I mean, he directed this. He co-wrote it. He co-wrote it along with Shel Silverstein.
The only feature film credit that he has, yeah.
And, I mean, this is a guy that, you know, for me, I mean, this is a part of my childhood, okay? The in the 70s, early 80s, every kid in my class, we're talking like I was probably in fifth, sixth grade or so, our favorite book was Where the Sidewalk Ends, his collection of poems, and he does the illustrations as well. If you look through the things that this guy has done, there's all kinds of unique things in there. He wrote the Johnny Cash classic, A Boy Named Sue.
Boy Named Sue, yeah.
You know?
When I was a kid, same as you, I used to check out Where the Sidewalk Ends from the library at my grade school. And then my sister and I used to read it a lot. And when she had her first child, I gave her Where the Sidewalk Ends as a Christmas present. You know, and that's, he's so ingrained into my childhood. And yeah, years later, I found out that he has written not one, but two, I think, of the most cleverly written pop songs. If you look at the lyrics to Boy Named Sue are just, they're so well done. And you don't think of, I was talking to my wife about this. You don't use the word clever to describe songs very often. I mean, maybe Weird Al. I'm sure the Beatles probably did have some cleverly written lyrics. But you look at A Boy Named Sue, and the other one I was going to mention, which I think you should probably know, would be a cover of A Rolling Stone by Dr. Hook. Shel Silverstein wrote that too. And so those two songs, I love just deciphering the lyrics, and just it puts a smile on your face. And it's really amazing. When you sent this movie, I'm like, Shel Silverstein and David Mamet? This is quite the – it's an odd couple because you've got one guy who's – I guess Shell's very clever with his poems and stuff. And then Mamet has a certain way of doing dialogue, which unfortunately is not really on display in this movie. It doesn't have that traditional Mamet dialogue.
So this film, it centers on a humble shoeshine man named Gino, played by Don Ameche, one of his last film roles, actually. Gino is approached by a mafia boss called Mr. Green to confess to a murder that one of his cohorts has been fingered for. Basically, the idea is that Gino resembles this guy, so he's going to sign a confession, so that then this other guy, who we assume is a mafia boss of some sort, is going to be off the hook. And, you know, the idea then, the deal is that he goes to jail for a few years. When he's out, he gets paid a whole bunch. You know, he can make his dreams come true. He says, what do you dream of? He says, oh, a fishing boat, you know, in Sicily. So they say, oh, you can get your fishing boat in Sicily. You're going to do this thing for me first. Now, at first he refuses, but then he changes his mind and he agrees to this plan. So now we've got a few days that are going to happen between when he's signed this confession and when it's handed over to the courts. So Gino needs to be kind of tucked away safe, so that nothing happens during this time. So the mobsters bring in one of their goons, a guy named Jerry, played by Joan Mantegna. He's going to keep an eye on him. Now, he's a bit of a screw up in the past. So, you know, he's kind of on probation with them. So they give him this job to redeem himself. But also, I think because it's kind of a stinky job, you know, like, well, somebody's got to do it. So we're going to give it to Jerry here. He's a screw up. Let him prove that he's not a screw up. So it doesn't take long for Jerry to get a bit bored of just hanging around with this old man in a cramped hotel room. So he decides he's going to give Gino a bit of fun before he is sent off to prison. And so they end up hopping a plane going from Chicago to Lake Tahoe. And as soon as they arrive there, another mob goon of some sort recognizes Jerry. He's played by William H. Macy, actually, with bleached hair, which was kind of weird. But anyway, he spots Jerry, starts giving him a bit of a hard time because of his past screw-ups. Well, then Jerry creates this story that he is accompanying a mob bigwig, you know, like a VIP. He's the guy behind the guy behind the guy, he says.
Yes.
And so then William H. Macy and all these other folks start to assume that Gino is, you know, really this big mob boss. And so they all start, you know, kind of trying to butter them up. You know, they go to the fancy hotel and give him the best suite. And, you know, you've got unlimited credit, whatever you want, it's yours, that whole type of thing. And so these two are enjoying themselves for a while. You know, they're gambling, they're going to shows, they're hanging out with pretty girls, all that kind of stuff. But then there's some trouble that starts to brew because they're brought to meet with another Don who's played by Robert Prosky. He's basically trying to figure out what's going on here. Who's this guy? And then more problems come around when Mr. Green and his crew show up in Tahoe for a big meeting of the Dons. So as you kind of said before, this is got all kinds of people in it from Mamet's Atlantic Theater Company, show up in this film in small parts. Some of them are folks who were not famous at the time, but are now pretty well known. You know, folks like William H. Macy and Felicity Huffman and Clark Gregg has a small part of this. A bunch of other people, you know, as well.
J.T. Walsh, Ricky J. Yeah. Ricky Jay is in it. Jonathan Katz, the Dr. Katz, professional therapist, he's in it.
Right.
He's a Mamet collaborator, yeah.
Yeah, so, but as you kind of hinted at before, it's Mamet, but it's not your typical Mamet. So I'm going to go ahead and let you start us off here, Mike. What's your some of your thoughts on Things Change?
Well, the first thing that I had a real problem with, I will say, you know, I don't remember, we're not going to judge it on a scale or a thumbs up or a thumbs down. I was not necessarily impressed with this movie. I was a little disappointed because when I read the plot description, it sounds like it's going to be kind of a fun. Maybe is it a road trip movie? What's going to go on? These two guys are going to. Is it like a Midnight Run situation? It reminded me a lot of. Have you seen The Last Detail with Jack Nicholson? That. So I was thinking it's something like that. Well, I feel like we don't really get to know Gino at all. Like, I cannot remember the last time I've ever seen a movie with a protagonist that's that old. He's probably got to be in his 70s, if not 80. And he doesn't spin a tale about his life. We have no idea anything about his backstory. He has no backstory whatsoever that I can think of. And the whole time I'm watching it, you find yourself wondering, like, why exactly was he chosen? I know, like you mentioned, the plot gets in motion really quickly. They just, these two mobsters follow him in and then say, hey, we want you to meet this guy. Because you get to the office, and then they're like, you kind of look like this guy. We want you to take this rap. I don't understand. How did they find him? They don't nothing is explained. And I know sometimes you don't necessarily need that in a movie. Let's just move forward. It's fine. But did they frequent that shoeshine place? And then they were just like, hey, this guy looks kind of like this other guy. No, they just, they're just following him on the street. And then I still don't understand, like, you know, why would he agree to do it? You know, and at the same time, we've got what? It's an hour and 40 minutes, right? So it's like, you got 100 minutes. At no point does he really say, why did he agree to do it? Like, you see that scene when he says, oh, I can't do it. And then the mobster walks off in disgust. And then that's it. And then he just kind of has a moment. And I don't know if this is me not being deep enough into my film analysis to know that he just changes his mind all of a sudden. This is where you should have had another scene where he talked to somebody and kind of explained it. Like, why? But he seems to be such a loner that who would he even talk to? Like, we don't know anything about it. Does he have a family? Does he have children? Does he have grandchildren? We don't really get to know much about him in that regard. And so I thought it needed a little bit more plotting. You know, I feel like there was a lot of it was very derivative of other movies. Like I mentioned, The Last Detail or Midnight Run. You know, even did you notice that, like, when they go meet the Mr. Green of the mobster, that he's like in an office, and it's framed exactly like Michael Corleone from the end of The Godfather.
yeah.
With the doors to the left and the right, you know, and it's just like, I'm like, okay, it kind of seems like, I give Mamet credit. I know he knows what he's doing, but it also kind of seemed to me like it was someone who wasn't overly familiar with the mob. They were just going off of mob movies and trying to kind of write something based on that. So I didn't, you know, it's a very unique premise, but it just scratches the surface. It doesn't get any deeper than that. And I mean, I was clocking it with when I was watching, I had to, unfortunately, I looked it up when we chose the movie, and it was streaming on a service called Tubi, which I've used before. And then it left. I was looking for it. I watched the movie last night just to keep it fresh in my head, and it was gone. So I did rent it on iTunes, and I noticed that, like, Don Ameche and Joe Mantegna, the movie is almost half over before they really have an actual, like, conversation that's more than just a couple of sentences of Joe Mantegna telling Don Ameche what he needs to do. Like, we don't get to know anything about him. And then we don't get a really deep, meaningful conversation between the two of them until there's, like, 15 minutes left in the movie. So I will, in the interest of full disclosure, I would tell you, I have never seen Rain Man. I assume that Rain Man is supposed to be the image that I have in my mind of these two disparate characters, and they're together. So they're going to talk, and you're going to kind of get to know them. And especially when the movie is co-written and directed by a playwright who is known for having amazing dialogue and having characters who talk. I was a little bit baffled by that. Yeah.
I get where you're coming from on that. This is going to be interesting because I think we kind of went away with some different experiences here, because I recognize everything you're saying there. As I was watching the movie, I kind of thought, I think this could be a divisive film for some people, because it is a very, I guess the word that kept coming to my mind as I thought about it is that it's a very quiet film, which I was not at all expecting, considering, again, David Mamet. Again, I don't have a whole lot of exposure, but I know enough to know that this guy has a way with words, and also has a way with words that are, let's say, a bit fiery, you know?
Colorful.
Yeah, you know? And this movie is definitely not that. It's very low-key. You know, you talk about that first scene where the gangsters, Mr. Green, his associate, Ricky, played by Ricky Jay, they bring Don Ameche in there. They go through, you know, this whole thing. Don Ameche hardly says a single word in that. He nods. He sits there and listens. But it's all just very, very quiet. And it is a different tone than what you would expect for something from David Mamet. Also, I found a very different tone than what we would expect out of the gangster genre, if we want to call this a gangster film, which I think you can. But, you know, we're a few years before kind of the gangster boom of the early 90s, where you had like Goodfellas and Bugsy and Godfather 3 and Billy Bathgate.
Mobsters with
Mobsters, with Christian Slater.
Saw that in the theater. And good for you for giving a shout out. Billy Bathgate from Touchstone Pictures. Oh, very, absolutely. Very good movie.
Yeah. You know, but I mean, this is not that kind of a gangster film. This is a very subtle, low key. I mean, there's nothing boisterous about the gangsters in this film, and so I can get where that's a little strange and you know, isn't going to gel for a lot of viewers. I guess for me, what I kind of latched on with this was the dynamic between Don Ameche and Joe Mantegna. And I kind of liked the way that, even though you're right, you know, they don't really have a moment of them talking and, you know, connecting until, you know, a good amount into the movie. But I love the way that they kind of react to, let's call it, the madness that's going on around them, you know, as things get heightened and they come to Lake Tahoe and William H. Macy and all these other characters are, you know, kind of buttering them up and, you know, treating them a certain way because they're supposedly so important. And they just kind of silently go along with it. And there's, I guess. I was charmed by the subtlety of their performances in that.
Yeah, it was different. I'll give it to you. I'll definitely give that to you. Like, I was going to ask you too, the William H. Macy character, I couldn't quite figure out, because he seems to be like, he's same, that same low level mobster, like Joe Mantegna's Jerry character is.
Yeah.
But then because the way he kept like bringing up like, oh, I heard you screwed up, you know? And then when they get to Tahoe, Joe Mantegna makes it a point to kind of tell everybody, you know, don't draw attention to us. And then it seems like William H. Macy keeps trying to draw attention to them. And all I kept thinking was, is he doing that on purpose? Like, is he doing it on purpose so that he can score points with his, you know, to be like, to, and almost kind of subvert what Joe Mantegna is doing and get him in trouble even further? Like, it's, but they're not really going to, they don't work for the same boss. It just, I didn't understand some of that character, because it seemed like he was trying to undercut him. I thought, you know, but I didn't get that. Yeah.
It could be taken that way, I suppose. I guess I kind of thought that, you know, he's just seeing maybe this is an opportunity where, you know, I'm going to impress this other big boss, the guy behind the guy behind the guy, so to speak, because I want to take Jerry's place. You know, I want a higher level, whatever.
Okay.
I guess that's the way I saw it. But, and you know, I don't know. I think, you know, all the different characters that we see in this environment of the hotel and such, I think they're all kind of that way. The way that you see, like, the bellhop that, you know, is saying, oh, well, I can get you this and I can do this for you and anything you need. And J.T. Walsh, I love J.T. Walsh in this. Yeah. I thought he was great. And again, talking about kind of the power of some of the quieter moments, I think one of my favorite bits in this movie is when William H. Macy first brings them to the hotel lobby and saying, we need to get them a room. And J.T. Walsh reaches for, you know, the keys are there in the little cubbies and such. And he reaches for a key down low, and William H. Macy kind of, you know, gives him this weird look. And then he moves his hand up a few rows, and he's still like, no, 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 no. And he moves all the way up to the top, which you got to assume is like the penthouse or whatever. And he's like, yeah, that one, you know. And you see the changes in J.T. Walsh's expression and such as he's doing that, as he's slowly realizing that this guy's a big deal, you know, and we have to treat him with respect, you know. And also, I just get the impression of that too, that, you know, J.T. Walsh is just, you know, he's this guy who is under the thumb of the mob, so to speak, you know, that, you know, he runs this hotel in Tahoe, and it's a mob hotel. And, you know, there's always these big wigs coming through, and he's got to do these things for them. He's got to keep their secrets, et cetera, et cetera. And, you know, there's this look of respect and fear in him as he's realizing supposedly the status that Don Amici's character has.
And that shows what a talent he was. I mean, unfortunately gone far too soon, JT Walsh, but I was going to say, like, again, it goes back to what I think is where this movie is kind of derivative of other previous mob movies, mainly like the Godfather type films, because isn't Godfather 2 there in Tahoe, right?
I think you're right. Yeah.
Yeah. Like, I have not been there. We actually had a trip planned there and then the pandemic hit and we kind of canceled it, but I didn't realize, like, I can't picture that as being like this major mob place. But I mean, I guess it was, you know, that movie, it did kind of have like a throwback feel to it. Maybe it was, I watched it on iTunes. It just looked, the way that it was shot, it looked kind of flat. And I don't know if it was just whatever film stock they used and stuff. It kind of looked like something from the 70s or something that would have been like a TV movie. Like, it didn't look, it wasn't very glossy, which I guess you don't want, you want that from a mob, from a movie about the mob. And also, I'm going to do the finger quotes again and say comedy. Like, it was, I think it's only a comedy in the sense that it's just not a bunch of people getting shot everywhere, you know?
Yeah.
And they kind of make light of, like, Jerry Joe Mantegna's role within his little group. Like, I mean, it kind of reminded me a little bit, again, of The Godfather, those scenes where they're sitting around the kitchen table and they're just discussing what's going on. And I feel like with this movie, they take that scene, but then they kind of give it a little bit more of a comedic twist where you see like a chalkboard up on the wall where it's like, they're literally keeping track of all their racketeering, you know? Mm. But we're supposed to kind of, you have to know what's going on. Because if you haven't seen enough mob movies, because I like to think that people like you and I are not familiar with the actual mob. So we have
hopefully,
to see
yeah.
enough, you know, we have to see enough mob movies to understand, like, oh, that must be what they're doing. They're collecting money and they have these little brown envelopes and stuff. And Joe Mantegna is like washing dishes when you first see him. So you're like, okay, this is where the comedy comes into play. But I will say one of the things that I didn't realize I was going to appreciate until the movie was really going full steam was that Joe Mantegna is like perfectly cast for that role because
oh, yeah.
he seems like, not to mention the fact that he was Fat Tony for how many years on The Simpsons, he could be a comedy mobster, but he seems perfect at playing like that wise guy, the mob wise guy, but who's not like incredibly intimidating, right? Yeah. Like, you know, he wishes he was higher up, but he's stuck at this lower level. And I feel like when you see him in other movies, and I'm sure he was an imposing figure in his peak of his career, but he never really struck me as being like scary. Like, you'd see him in movies. He didn't play the heavy quite often. I don't think, I mean,
across in other films as more intimidating than he does here. I mean, here you're absolutely right where he, I think really sells being this low level guy, somewhat put upon, you know, I mean, love that he's introduced, you know, the first time we see him is that he's washing the dishes. I think that simple thing really communicates that this is a guy that's, you know, kind of walking a thin line here when it comes to his role in the mob.
Yeah. I was wondering, I mean, that the one question I had at the very end was, why is he even in the mob? Like, I mean, is it just something where it's the respect and, you know, that he could get? I don't know, because I will say that I thought the ending was somewhat predictable. And when you by the time you get to it and everything kind of wraps up, you find yourself going like, what did he get out of this? Like, why is he still with? I mean, now how hard is it to get out? I don't know how that works. You know, like, they don't just let you leave, right? Like, what would have driven him to this? He seems very uneasy, and he seems, like I said, it fits for a comedy because of the fact that it's like, well, he's not, I don't know if he would be, I wouldn't say he's like, he's not like De Niro and Analyze This, right? He's not like a total
lampoon
of it, but it's something where he's definitely not serious. And I think mob movies play better when they're more serious. And I'm sure there's been mob type comedies, but this kind of fits. And the fact that he obviously has worked with Mamet so many times that I liked him in this role. Now with Don Amici, I can't, you know, I think as you probably saw it on the IMDb trivia section, I saw it on the AFI's website as well, that Don Amici was actually going to be one of the other bosses that shows up in the third act for the big boss meeting. And then they decided, mm-hmm. oh, let's just let him be Gino instead. I didn't really get enough out of him. I to be honest, I thought his accent was very distracting too.
I can get that. I mean, it's you kind of said the word cartoonish a little earlier, and if there's anything cartoonish about the movie, it's Don Amici's accent.
Mm-hmm. yeah.
But I think in a lot of ways, And again, this is one of the things that I think throws the viewer a bit. We've talked about how this isn't your typical kind of mob movie, and kind of the feel of things is not what you expect. It's not The Godfather. It's not Goodfellas. And I think in a lot of ways, these two characters that we spend a lot of time with here are almost presented like they're children. You know, they have a very childlike approach to what's going on here. I mean, Don Ameche, when they have the scenes, like, for example, when they go gambling and such, he's playing these games with this like wide-eyed innocence, and he's, you know, like he's never done these games before and all that, you know, and he just, oh, I put this here, okay, you know, I win, yeah, you know, it just has a real childlike quality to it. And Joe Mantegna, I think, at the same time I think the way he approaches this whole assignment he's giving is like a child, you know, like he gets bored by the fact that he's got to watch this guy. Well, what are we going to do? Let's go have some fun. Let's go to Tahoe. It never, you know, occurs to him like, you know, this isn't a good idea. You know, I'm going to get caught. I'm going to get in bigger trouble than I've already been in. He just does it, you know, kind of on a whim like that.
He gets upset like a petulant child, too.
Like,
when you watch it, it seems like it kind of reminds me of like Cartman on South Park, like respect my authority, right? Like he wants to be so important. He wants to climb back up the mob ranks. And when stuff doesn't quite go his way, he throws a fit, you know, like a toddler almost. So I could see that. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Well, and jumping back to what you were saying a few moments ago, too, you said how it felt like. I don't remember what word you use, but like an older film. Yeah, as I watched it too, I was like, yeah, it kind of feels like it's a little out of time. It's set in 1988, you know, in the present day or when it was made. But kind of the feel of things, I thought, oh, you know, they could have just as well set this in the 40s, you know, and really not had to change much of this. You know, it just has that kind of old soul type of feel to it.
I think I might have played better if it would have been back. You could sort of lampoon it a little bit more. Like, so I'll bring up Touchstone Pictures again. One of my favorite discoveries of my podcast was Oscar, the John Landis film with Steve Sylvester Stallone.
We did an episode on that on this show many moons ago. Yeah.
Oh, okay. Yeah. It sort of sends it up, and that's actually one of the things that I was thinking about. Like, I thought Mammoth should be better than this when it comes to like this cartoony depiction of mobsters, but then I was thinking, maybe he didn't want to be too literal. He didn't want to get in trouble, you know, with somebody saying, like, how do you know the inner workings? You know, I feel like Scorsese gets a pass. Like, people don't mind when he makes mob movies, but it's almost like, okay, you can't make it too realistic because then someone's going to ask some questions and figure out, how did you know that? You know, and I think maybe that's what it is. Maybe he was trying to just sort of send it up and base it on other movies that he had seen. That's kind of what I thought. And like I said, with Joe Mantegna does play perfectly into that because there's so many guys that you could... You know, would you rather have had a De Niro type playing this? De Niro works for a movie like Midnight Run because you could believe when he gets upset, you don't want him to be upset. Whereas with Joe Mantegna, when he gets upset in this movie, you're kind of like, you know, you're not scared. You're almost laughing a little bit. And I wonder if that's what Don Ameche's character was he setting him off sometimes too. You know, there's a moment where he wakes up and then Joe Mantegna wakes up in the morning and he can't find Don Ameche. And he's freaking out. Where my first thought is like, okay, where could he be? He's got to be somewhere nearby. You don't need to go that crazy. But yet he's kind of hamming it up and he's going nuts. And then when you finally see him, he's just down the hall, and he's just got, like I said, he's got that childlike innocence where he's just like, oh, I'm just getting my shoe shine.
Yeah, and I like that moment. Yeah. I like him, you know, because what he's doing there is basically giving you know, lessons to the bellhop about how to shine the shoes. Which, you know, first of all, I'm wondering, well, how's the bellhop reacting to this? Because he thinks he's a big mob boss, and instead he's giving him all kinds of wisdom about shining shoes.
Maybe he might get some favors down the line, you know, right?
Yeah, who knows? But I don't know. Again, I was charmed, I think, by, you know, the idea of Don Ameche's character. He's so proud of his shoe shining, I guess, you know, as the movie starts, you think, well, is that it? This is just a guy that shines shoes for a living in 1988, you know, how do you survive, you know, and you know, but you know, in this scene, he's like, You know, it's like he's passing on his wisdom. This is the one thing in the world that he knows that he's good at. He's passing that on to this bellhop in a fancy
Again,
hotel.
No backstory. That's where I would have liked to have known. It's set in Chicago. Is this an Italian Sicilian neighborhood in Chicago? How long has he been doing this? Why does he, what kind of, you know, you don't see him like shining the shoe of a customer first. You only see him walking to the office and then he's sitting down to do work. And that's when they kind of walk in. Like, we don't get enough of that backstory to kind of see why is he that way that he is. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And, yeah. You know, we've mentioned him kind of in passing, but I do want to bring up Robert Prosky. And I brought it up on our show because right around this, it's actually, I think 1 year before things change, Robert Prosky is in Outrageous Fortune, the Touchstone picture. And he plays kind of a duplicitous type character. And I remember being really upset, and I kind of jokingly mentioned it on that episode that I did, that Robert Prosky should always be lovable. Like, he's just that guy. And when I saw ahead of time that, okay, he's playing a character named Don Giuseppe. And when you first see him, he's trying to give off that sort of intimidating vibe. And he almost might be having Don Amici killed right in front of him. And then it sort of switches around. And then we get this weird kind of, is it Sicilian honor? Why is he nice to him? And because he's got this coin that he got from the other mob boss. And then for the rest of the movie, Robert Prosky does kind of become that sort of lovable, likable character that we've always had. But I'm just wondering, like, do we like Robert Prosky as a mob boss, or does it work because this is, there's that word again, comedy, finger quote, comedy from David Mamet, where Robert Prosky could be a mob boss in a movie like this?
I think it's the latter, because it was strange, you know, to see him come on screen and be a mob boss, because I'm right there with you. I'm thinking, well, Robert Prosky, I mean, he's Santa Claus, you know, I mean, he's just this lovable, cuddly type of guy. You don't expect him, you know, to see him playing a hardened criminal. And so, yeah, it was surprising at first, but then when it does turn to where, you know, he is a bit more lovable and becomes this great friend in a matter of just a few hours, you know, with Don Amici's character, I was like, okay, well, that's the Robert Prosky that we all know and love there, you know? So, that seems like as good a place as any to talk about some of the other supporting players. I mean, this movie is primarily Don Amici and Joe Mantegna. They take up most of the screen time, but we have other people that come and go. And we've mentioned a few of them here. You know, we talked about JT Walsh and such, but I guess who are some others that caught your eye in this film?
Well, as a flip side to the mobster that Robert Prosky plays, the mobster, Mr. Green in the film is played by the actor named Mike Nussbaum. He is really more effective because he's more of that quiet, steely face where when he gets upset when Don Amici first turns him down, like, okay, you could see him having somebody taken care of. You know what I mean? Like, he was very believable in that part. Just I like that. It's a character we don't really need to know much of their backstory because they probably don't want you to know their backstory. So that sort of works. And I think, you know, when you see these type of mob movies, they're going to be full of a lot of character actors that you recognize. And I do want to call out the other one that caught my attention was the character of Frankie, which is played by J.J. Johnston. And yes. I'll put it in my notes. All I wrote down was one of those faces where he's just, you know, he's been in a bunch of Mamet stuff as well, but he's just that guy. Like you could see him as a car salesman. You could see him as, I believe he was the ring announcer in Red Belt, the David Mamet movie about kickboxing, and so you could see him as that. You could see this guy being in Atlantic City or Lake Tahoe fitting in there, even though he's in Chicago for this movie.
What I always remember him from, because when he popped up in this movie, I was like, I know him, you know, where do I know him from? And suddenly I realized, oh, he's in JFK in a very small part. He's the guy I think it's Michael Rooker that he's talking to. And he's the guy that says, yeah, Clay Bertrand is Clay Shaw. What's the big deal? Everybody knows, you know, I was like, oh, it's that guy. I've watched that movie way too much, I guess.
he's like a mobster, right?
He's like, you know, he's some low level criminal on Bourbon Street or something like that. He's like, yeah, you know, everybody knows that guy, you know?
I remember years ago, I remember there was like a, I don't know if it was on AMC or something. They made a documentary about mob movies and they had all these different character actors who had been in a bunch of them. And you're like, okay, yeah, I know that. Recognize. Yeah, sure. Yeah. Seen that guy, you know, and that's, It's a collective. It's sort of a fraternity for these guys. And so they did cast that role. Ricky Jay, I mean, I love Ricky Jay. I have met him. I got his autograph at a screening. It was a movie he did for David Mamet called Heist with Gene Hackman and Delroy Lindo that I really liked. And he was doing I think I brought my DVD of Heist to get David Mamet to sign it at a screening, and Ricky Jay was there. So I was like, oh, hey, would you mind signing this as well? You know, obviously, I think he was a very famous sleight of hand artist, magician. And so is he going to be a mobster? I guess. I mean, because he is kind of that quiet type. So it would kind of play into that one. But again, maybe that plays back to that. It's like a comedy, not quite a serious mob movie. Like, did you ever see the, what's it called? Was it Wise Guys? Is that the one with Joe Piscopo and Danny DeVito?
Another one we covered on the show many, many moons ago. Yes.
Where it's like, if you're gonna lampoon the mob, you know, you don't have to go. Touchstone Pictures, I haven't gotten to it yet. I think it comes in the late 90s. They did the movie Jane Austen's Mafia with Lloyd Bridges playing like the mob boss. I feel like this is the way, if you're going to make a mob comedy, do it like this, where it's kind of quasi-serious and like Wise Guys. That, I mean, I love De Palma. So it kind of works in that, like, they're regular people and then they kind of get mixed up in the mob, but it doesn't kind of go too crazy. And I think that was one of the flaws that I had with this movie, is that the third act of this movie does sort of descend into farce. Because, it kind of reminded me a little bit of What's Up, Doc, you know, at the very end, where it was something that Howard Hawks and Peter Bogdanovich would have done that would have been really proud, where it's like, oh, the bosses are here. Now I got to hide over here. Now I can't go over here. I got to go through a window.
Yes.
You know, and I was like, okay. And then he's like, now we're going to drive back to Vegas. Oh, I've only got a dollar. Oh, now the gas station attendant's going to keep my car keys. And then they magically get bailed out of that situation due to a very fortunate circumstance, which I hate what I call on my show plot conveniences. Don't make plot conveniences if you can't kind of dig your characters out of a mess. And I think that kind of happened with this one. So the third act kind of left me a little bit, but
you're right. The third act does kind of, it gets close to that territory. I always refer to it as a door slamming comedy, you know, like where people are running around and slamming doors and avoiding each other and all that kind of stuff.
So, it works in certain situations. I mentioned Bogdanovich, What's Up, Doc? One of the other Touchstone Pictures we watch for our show, I absolutely love Noises Off.
I knew you were going to say it. I love Noises Off too.
Yeah, Noises Off is brilliant. And so, you know, things like that, where it's like, okay, when we're used to it, if you're going to try to inject that into a mob movie, there was no sense of that type of comedy for the first, you know, hour of the film. And then all of a sudden you're like, okay, well, now we're going to drop this in at the end. And it's like, okay, yeah, I guess. I mean, and I think that was, you know, when you watch any kind of a movie, right, you want to feel sympathetic to the characters or relate to them somehow. And I thought, you know, when it came to the Joe Mantegna character, you know, you wanted to get out of the predicament, I guess, because at the same time, you find yourself saying he put himself into this predicament. Like, it's kind of hard to root for him in that sense, because you're like, why didn't you just stay in Chicago? Like, even if you didn't want to go to if you didn't want to sit in this hotel room for 3 days, you could have at least done something. You know, you could drive to Milwaukee. You could go to Gary, Indiana. I don't know.
Come on. Who wants to go to Milwaukee or Gary? Give me a break.
Well, yeah. the Quad Cities, you know. I'm from Southern Illinois, so you go down to St. Louis. There's plenty of stuff to do down there. Yeah. Go to the Arch.
Go to Peoria or something like
that. Yeah. So by making it into where he's going to go so far away that it's going to be very hard for him to cover his tracks if something goes wrong, and then something goes wrong, and then all of a sudden it just becomes – okay, now we have to figure this out. It was very movie. You know what I mean? It seemed like a movie plot. And I think that's something that you know, Mamet probably hadn't really dealt with. I think I read that, you know, he'd done House of Games the year before, and that was his first theatrical film, or his first theatrical director credit. He'd had some movie credits. I forgot he wrote The Untouchables around the same time as things changed.
Yeah.
And so I think maybe that's sort of like, when you're doing a play, you're a little bit more constrained by the stage, whereas doing this movie, it's like, okay, now I gotta come up with something for the third act that's going to have like a little bit of, I don't want to say zaniness, but, you know, some sort of odd predicament that they have to get themselves out of. And it was like, yeah, but, and at the same time, it's like, you know, you don't, there's that saying about like when you have a movie character and you kill them off, you got to give the audience a reason to care about them. I'm not, no spoilers here. I'm not saying anybody dies in this movie or doesn't die in this movie. You have to watch for yourself. You have to give them enough reason for the audience to care about their death. Otherwise, it's just meaningless. It's like watching a war movie and seeing a soldier get shot. Mm-hmm. And so with this movie, it's hard when everything kind of goes off the rails in the third act, and when it gets wrapped up in the end with that somewhat predictable ending, I'm not happy or sad or anything, because I haven't really gotten to know either one of them well enough. And I think that's one of the things. I wish we could have gotten some more backstory, even anything more about Joe Mantegna. How hard would it have been? David Mamet! How hard would it have been for him to just throw in a quick monologue about why, you know, have Don Ameche ask Joe Mantegna, why are you joining the mob? You know, or something like that. And then the same way is Chris, because Joe Mantegna has that really great moment. Probably one of my favorite moments is that moment where Joe Mantegna tries to get him to leave at the end, because he knows that something's going to go wrong before it does. But he doesn't, he doesn't have that moment where he asks Don Ameche, why did you do this? Because I still don't understand why he did it. But they have this moment where he's just like, you know, this is 3 years of your life. You're going to be in jail, but it's going to be so different. You know, that makes sense. But that's where I just needed a little bit more interplay between the two of them. And we just didn't get it. Yeah.
Yeah. I get everything you're saying there. And I think, like I said earlier, this is a movie that people are going to come in different camps on, for sure. Everything that you're saying, I think, is valid. A lot depends on, you know, how you are able to take a very quiet, very subtle gangster film. And, yeah, you know, there were parts of it that charmed me. I think your frustrations with the plot, the lack of backstory and such, I'm on board with you. I think there are, you know, certainly some challenges there for the viewer. I think I was a bit more charmed by the two characters than you were. So.
Yeah, I mean, I would recommend the film only from the sense that it has such, it's a very unique premise, and they didn't just play it for laughs like Midnight Run, you know, or the traditional version of that story, which would be like The Last Detail, you know, where they have, Last Detail has backstory, has a lot of scenes between Jack Nicholson and Randy Quaid, you know. Whereas this one, it's always worth it for the stellar cast, and then, like you said, a unique premise, and then getting a chance to see a different side of the mob, because it's not, like I said, it's somewhere in between The Godfather and Oscar.
I think that's a good assessment.
And one more thing, Todd, I want to know, I kind of got a smile on my face when I was watching the movie, and that scene when Joe Mantegna tells William H. Macy that Don Ameche is the guy behind the guy behind the guy. Because I'd seen Swingers years ago, and I thought that was an original Doug Liman line. I thought that was that Vince Vaughn character. Something Vince Vaughn would say. I did not realize, does this line come from something else? I want to give credit to Mamet and Chell Silverstein for coming up with it.
I honestly don't know.
Because it's so funny, because Vince Vaughn kind of reminds me a little bit of Joe Mantegna in this movie, where it's somebody who wishes he was a little bit more important than he is.
Yeah, no, I think that's a good comparison. Yeah. All right, well, let's take a quick break here. We'll hear from another Lamb Podcasting Network show, and then we'll be back with our movie recommendations here on the Forgotten Filmcast.
You'll save money and time. You'll get the best of merchandise and service when you patronize these good neighbors. Shop with them regularly for friendly service and money-saving values.
At Cinema Recall, we want to present to you the finest in film analysis.
Yeah, like action and gore and sex.
We will look at classics by Kubrick, Lynch, Godard, De Palma, and Coppola.
I don't know who the f*** that is, but I'm looking at classic bodies of Christina Hendricks, Keanu Reeves, Salma Hayek, Ryan Reynolds.
We are a serious show for film lovers who enjoy indie foreign films, art house gems, and classic black and white features.
Well, I enjoy big budget blockbusters with great action and sexy people. Maybe our podcast can celebrate all aspects of films, like people who feel like your weird way and like people who feel like my weird way can like get together, man.
They can?
Yeah.
Huh. You know, I like that.
Cinema Recall is available everywhere you find great podcasts. Follow them on Facebook and Instagram under Cinema Recall Podcast, and on Twitter at @cinema_recall.
Hi, everybody. This is Todd. Just a quick reminder that you can now help support the Forgotten Filmcast through Patreon. For just a few dollars a month, you can support this show and earn some access to some great bonus features, including a bunch of the older episodes of the show that are no longer available on the main podcast feed. Visit patreon.com/forgottenfilmcast to learn more.
For your convenience, we have an attractive snack stand with buttered popcorn, golden good and hot from the popper, sizzling hot dogs cradled in fresh, fluffy buns, ice cream, and other good things to eat.
Okay, welcome back. It's time for our movie recommendations. This is the part of the show where myself and my guest each get to talk a bit about another movie that we've really enjoyed that we just want to spread the word about. It could be a forgotten film. It could be an old classic, something new in theaters, something on streaming. Could be absolutely anything. So, Mike, what is your recommendation?
Well, I know you don't necessarily have a guide for how we do our recommendations, but last time I was on the show, we did The Distinguished Gentleman was a movie we talk about, and then my recommendation was another Eddie Murphy movie. So I was like, let's kind of keep it the synergy of things change. And so I wanted to actually do another movie from David Mamet. I mentioned it earlier when we were part of recording. I'll just try to go as quickly as I can and tell you. I mentioned that I've come across David Mamet three different times in my life. Once was at a restaurant. He was sitting a couple tables over from me. He lives in Santa Monica, so I used to go to this theater in Santa Monica all the time, and he'd be there. He would pop up. I've met William H. Macy and Clark Gregg at their own Q&As. I've gotten them to autograph DVDs and stuff, and Mamet will pop up. I've met him and his wife have been in the audience. His wife, Rebecca Pigeon, she's been in a bunch of stuff as well. But there was one time, I think it was at a screening that William H. Macy for a movie he'd been in, where when the movie was over, I went into the bathroom, and there was three urinals in the bathroom. And I was in the far right urinal, and Mamet was in the middle urinal, and another guy came up into the left urinal. So of course, it's a urinal. David Mamet's in there. I'm not gonna bug this guy, obviously. And the guy on the left, in the left urinal, was like, "Hey, Mr. Mamet, I'm a big fan, and you know, I took this course that you had. I don't know if it was an online course or in person. He was just like, I was in this screenwriting course you had. I learned so much from it." And then we just looked at him and was like, are we going to do this here? Is this what you wanted to do? This is really how you want to do this, huh? And I'm dying laughing. And I finish up, I'm washing my hands, and he kind of walked over. And I said, I was going to tell you that I loved Red Belt, but I thought it'd be a good time to wait. And he was like, I appreciate that, you know? And so it was just like, yeah, I mean, I had James Cromwell at a urinal next to me one time too. You don't say anything. There's definitely, when they're eating and when they're relieving themselves is when you don't do. This is the Forgotten Film Cast. And I think sometimes the recommendation should be something that maybe it would be forgotten. On the last time I was on, that my recommendation was Bowfinger. And I remember thinking when that came out, it came out when I was in film school. And it's not forgotten, it's Bowfinger. But, you know, we're 20 years on now, and I don't know if everybody knows about Bowfinger anymore. And so the movie that I chose was a movie that came out in the year 2000. And I saw it in the theater, absolutely loved it. I tell everybody that I talk to, you have to see it if you haven't, because when it came out, everybody knew about it. And for the 5 years after, maybe the 10 years after, oh yeah, everyone knows that one. Well, now we're 23 years later, and maybe everybody doesn't know about State and Main. And that kind of makes me sad, because if you remember, Todd, when State and Main came out, that was like a big deal, because it had a lot of the David Mamet, his repertory, mm-hmm. But then it also had just a bunch of up-and-comers, and it had Julia Stiles, and it had Philip Seymour Hoffman, and it has Alec Baldwin and Charles Durning, and you know, Clark Gregg was still kind of coming up, but it's such a terrific movie. And I feel like we talked about it on my show as well, about how like Ed Wood didn't do very well at the box office. And there's this idea that movies about movies, they don't really play very well to the rest of America. Right. They're really big in New York and LA for sure. And I feel like everyone should really see State and Main, because it's this really charming movie about a movie. And it has some of that amazing Mamet dialogue, which Todd, have you seen State and Main?
I actually haven't. I was looking up some stuff just a few weeks back, you know, looking at, I don't remember whose filmography I was looking at, but State and Main came up as I was looking at it. And I went, oh my gosh, I kind of like what you were saying. I remember this movie coming out. I remember it was, kind of a big deal, and I never saw it. So yeah, I've been kind of like, I need to see that.
Of course it would turn up in someone's filmography, because everybody's in this movie, you know? And that's why I find it so hard to believe. Like, I don't want to go off on a tangent, but we talk about how, like, you know, if people don't talk about stuff, stuff's going to get forgotten. And there was a musician that my father loved, and it passed it on to me. and his name was Gene Pitney. Do you remember Gene Pitney?
The name sounds familiar. Remind me.
He did The Man Who Shot Liberty Valance and Town Without Pity.
Yes, you know? Yes.
And he's one of those great, amazing singing voice. And Gene Pitney was always on in the house when I was a kid. And I have since got a Gene Pitney 2-disc best of to play on in my house. And I remember it makes me nervous to think that in another generation, fewer and fewer people are going to know who Gene Pitney is. And so something like State in Maine, I think for the longest time, I just looked it up. It didn't get released on Blu-ray until 2 years ago. Mm. Like, it was only a standard def DVD. I don't know maybe it's streaming somewhere, because I believe New Line put it out. But I bought the DVD when it came out, because I said, again, I saw it in the theater. That was a really good year for movies. I was only in film school for 2 years, and we had a lot of good stuff in that 99-2000 era. And I had this DVD from back then, and the funny part is, it's ended up becoming like it's a keepsake now, because that's what I use to get autographs. So my copy of State in Maine, I would bring it back to that theater whenever anybody showed up. So that DVD has been signed by David Mamet, William H. Macy, Clark Gregg, Rebecca Pigeon. I think Ricky Jay signed my Heist DVD, but not my State in Maine one. I was always saving it with Julia Stiles or Alec Baldwin whenever does a Q&A, you know. And what's so funny is, one of the things you need to see about this movie is, we're talking about how Joe Montaigne is not a very intimidating gangster, or wishes he was a little bit more intimidating. There is I don't know if he'd be a gangster, but he's sort of kind of like the money man in State in Maine. And it's David Paymer. And if you think of David Paymer as sort of like that nebbish, he's the quintessential nebbish when it comes to movies.
Yeah, oh yeah, yeah.
But he is like this really intimidating, powerful person in the movie. And he's pushing people around, and he's yelling, and he's kind of throwing his weight around, and he's scaring people. And it's so funny, because you're just like, this is not the David Paymer that I expect. But yeah, I think I looked it up. There's like 6 or 7 different people in State in Maine that were in Things Change 12 years later, basically. Yeah. Yeah, but it's a movie about a Hollywood crew goes to Vermont. They go to Vermont to shoot a movie, and then everything just goes wrong. But it works more of like a farce, more than like the third act of Things Change, because it's sort of set up like that, where the locals kind of view the Hollywood types as, oh God, what are they doing here? But they also know, hey, it'll help draw attention to our small town. And it's Mamet's dialogue. It's very, very, very cleverly written. And it's got, we said, the colorful language, right? Obviously, Mamet's whole thing is cursing for effect, you know, or just being very blunt. And I don't mind. I curse occasionally. And sometimes you do it for, it works to kind of drive a point home. You don't just throw it out willy-nilly. But yeah, I don't even want to say any more about it. I just feel like we need to keep it out there so that people know. It kills me to think that there are people that are in their 20s that are streaming stuff and grew up watching YouTube and have no idea that this movie exists, you know?
Excellent. Well, yeah, I need to check that one out. I will make that happen sometime soon here. Well, the movie that I'm going to recommend, this is one that is on that list of things I probably should have seen before just 2 weeks ago, but I happened to watch this 2 weeks ago. And I guess as I was thinking about Things Change and how it's kind of a quiet film, like what we were saying here, and deals with two guys who kind of have a unique friendship, this is another movie that's very quiet, and it's about two guys that have a unique friendship. This is from 1973. It's Scarecrow, starring Gene Hackman and Al Pacino.
Okay.
And I just, you know, like sat down one Sunday night a few weeks ago and was like, oh, okay, Scarecrow's on HBO Plus. Let's watch that. I've never watched it before. And I really enjoyed it. It, you know, I mean, first of all, I'll watch anything with Gene Hackman in it, you know, so
sure.
I had to mark this one off the list. But Gene Hackman and Al Pacino basically play two drifters who are making their way from California to Pittsburgh. Hackman is an ex-con, and he's got plans to go into the car wash business. And he meets Pacino one day. They're both kind of hitchhiking on the same stretch of road, and Pacino just kind of latches on to him, you know. And so they're both heading out east, you know, trying to make a new life for themselves. And, you know, there's just a lot of this is just kind of seeing the way these two guys walk in and out of these different environments, deal with the people around them and such. Hackman is great. He's always great, but you know, one of my all time favorites. And here he plays just a real kind of hothead character. And you know, again, talking about how, you know, I said in Things Change, how it struck me that these two characters are very childlike. Pacino in this, very childlike. I mean, this is not at all a role I expect to see Al Pacino in, but I mean, he basically is almost like a little puppy following Gene Hackman around in this film. Yeah. But it makes for a real interesting dynamic between the two. It's a road movie, and I have a real soft spot for road movies. Part of it even took place here in Denver, so I was like, oh, hey, I recognize where they are there, so that's always fun to see. Oh, but, nice. You know, another quiet movie, but strong performances, is still kind of packs a punch. So, yeah, I enjoyed Scarecrow quite a bit.
Yeah, it's another one of those ones we were talking about, the 70s auteurs and stuff. When I think of 70s films, that's one of those ones. Unfortunately, I have not seen that one, but I am familiar with it. There's a lot of Al Pacino's 70s work outside of The Godfather that I have not seen, just because I'm one of the people who thinks that Dog Day Afternoon is kind of overrated. So I'm a child of the 80s and I like the 80s movies. The 70s auteur picks are not quite my thing, but I'm always open to watching them. I'd seen, like I said, The Last Detail was one that I always wanted to see because my father was in the Navy and he used to always talk about it. But Scarecrow, for sure. I'll have to check that out.
Excellent. Well, Mike, I want to thank you for being on the show. Before I let you go here, please remind everybody of where they can find you and your show and all that good stuff.
Oh, yeah. Like I said, it's a real pleasure to be back. Like I said, I know you have an affinity for the disc film, so I'm flattered that you seem to want to listen to me talk about Touchstone movies. But yeah, the podcast is called Out of Touchstone. I'm on Twitter I run the Out of Touchstone Twitter account. It's at Out of Touchstone. And the Instagram is same thing, at Out of Touchstone. And then I have a personal Twitter account. I mean, I don't use it as much due to the new proprietor of Twitter. I'm a little bit not as interested in going on there. I'm just go on there for news and then get off. Whereas Instagram's a little bit more happening. It's more positive. And so I find myself over there. But yeah, like I said, we do episodes. We try to do them every 2 weeks. So we're wrapping up 1994. We have we always do, we hand out our Ronnie Awards. I call them the Ronnie Awards, named after the founder of the first president of Touchstone Pictures, Ron W. Miller, Walt Disney's son-in-law. And so we'll be handing out our 1994 Ronnie Awards soon. And then we go into 1995, which was a year that Touchstone only put 6 movies out in 1995, but Hollywood put out 16. So I got to figure out how I'm going to spread those out, where you may have to just, I'll have an episode for each of the Touchstone movies. And then maybe we'll just pack all the Hollywood ones into one episode, or I don't need to go too deep into some of these movies. Sure, I'll watch Crimson Tide. I've never seen it. I've never seen Nixon, you know, or Mr. Holland's Opus, but do I need to see Scarlet Letter? You know, do I need to see some of those other ones? I'm like, we'll see. But yeah, that's basically what I'm doing. And I do thank you for the invite and for giving me a chance to watch some more Mammoth. I hope you will take this as an opportunity to do the same. I mean, I've heard House of Games is supposed to be really good. I've never quite seen that. I just know, I think he came into my purview in the late 90s when I was reading the St. Louis Post-Dispatch, my local newspaper back home, and there was a 4-star review in the paper for a movie that I had never heard of that was called The Spanish Prisoner. And it said, Steve Martin plays a nefarious character. And I was like, huh, what is this movie? And I drove an hour to the movie theater, the only movie theater that was playing it, and I drove an hour to see it. And I was like, I have never seen a movie with that much dialogue. That kind of dialogue. I'd seen Glengarry Glen Ross later, but Spanish Prisoner is another one of those ones that I would recommend. I think he did that right. And I think State and Main was not far behind it. So that late 90s, early 2000s. And then I said the screening where I saw him do a Q&A was with Red Belt. And that was really good too. But yeah, go watch The Mammoth. And for the listeners, yeah, go check out Things Changing. We missed Don Ameche. I mean, it's funny to think about that. Do you ever look at his career? Isn't it crazy? It was like he was in like 3 or 4 movies every year for like a 10-year stretch from the mid-30s to the mid-40s. Then it was just basically TV and Love Boat and stuff like that from the 70s. And then all of a sudden it was like Trading Places and Cocoon. And then the next thing you know, this guy is like so hot. And he gets this movie. Yeah.
That's what winning an Oscar will do, I guess.
Sure.
All right. Well, thanks again for being on the show, and I will be back to close things here in just a moment here on the Forgotten Filmcast. Well, everybody, that brings us to the end of this episode of the show. Thank you so much for listening. If you'd like to see other reviews of Forgotten Films, you can find them over at the Forgotten Films blog. That's at forgottenfilmcast.wordpress.com. You can also follow me on Twitter at Forgotten Films. That's films with a Z. And you can like Forgotten Films at Facebook. I'd also love to hear your questions, comments, and feedback about the show. So please email me at forgottenfilmcast@gmail.com. And don't forget to visit our Patreon page, patreon.com/forgottenfilmcast, where you can learn all about how you can help support this show. Thanks again for listening, and until next time, go watch some old movies.
Babe, this is the guy behind the guy. Behind the guy.
This podcast is a proud member of the Lamb Podcasting Network. Find the network at largeassmovieblogs.com.